This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Teacher pay, mental health programs, school safety, they're all top of mind among administrators, but they all cost money. And if the district doesn't have that money, they need to ask for it. School referendums are on a lot of Indiana ballots this coming Tuesday. So this hour, we're looking at what they are, what they're for, and how we might pay for them. As always, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. How have you voted when the question comes up? Have you always supported them? Does it depend on what they're asking for? Or maybe you wish the money came from somewhere other than property taxes. Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll do our best to share it with our panel of guests today. Joining me live from WFIU in Bloomington is Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Jeannie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basic question. School referendums have been around for a while in Indiana, but can you explain what they are and who can propose them?
Sure. So, yeah, like you said, referenda have been an option for schools for some time. But a decade ago, the legislature passed something called property tax caps, which limits how much tax money that local government agencies can collect from property taxes. And so when that happened, referenda became way more popular, and schools started proposing those to ask voters for specific approval to collect money beyond the capped amount. And so we've seen more school districts doing that. Most haven't yet. But still, I think there are about just around 60 school districts that are collecting referendum approved funding. And so that's traditional public school districts. I know that there are some local government agencies that can also propose referenda. I think last year there was one for a jail, actually, in the county. I don't remember which one. But something we've been hearing a lot of folks talk about at the state level, too, is that charter schools are actually getting more interested in getting some of those referendum dollars, too. And so there was a bill in the state house earlier this year that kind of proposed the idea of sharing referendum dollars between traditional public school districts and charter schools. That did not pass, so that's not happening. But it was also something that has come up this summer as lawmakers are talking about it. So we could see a bill coming up this upcoming legislative session that might propose some type of way to get charter schools a chunk of that referendum money. It's really complicated, so we'll have to see how they do it or if they do it, but that's a conversation that's going on. But right now, traditional public school districts.
Another thing that's complicated, and it's totally an aside, but just kind of a funny debate we've had around here, is referenda versus referendums. I wish we had time
right.
to get into it. But
yeah.
let's stay on topic. How many referendum measures will be on ballots next week?
Yeah, so there are 13 total, and so that's not 13 school corporations or districts. Some of them are proposing two types at once, and so we can talk a little bit more about that. But there are 13 different measures around the state next week.
And we'll dig into the details a little more throughout today's show. But can you give us a general sense of what most of these are about? I understand there are different categories they can fit into.
Right. So kind of like I was just saying, there are some school corporations that are proposing an operations referendum and a construction referendum. And so the operations is a referendum asking for money about, you know, kind of the general operating things within the district. So programs, you know, busing, you know, teachers, teacher retention, finding teachers. And then there are construction referenda that focus specifically on, you know, construction, so renovating buildings, building a school, and that type of stuff. And then there's a third category this year that I'm sure you'll talk about with Eric later, but school safety is a third category that lawmakers just approved this legislative session. And so when schools file with the state what they want to, you know, propose a referendum for, they have to kind of explain, you know, what they want to use it for. And And so some of the things we've seen in those filings and the conversations I've had with some of the folks that I've talked to, a lot of it focuses on, like I said, transportation, you know, teachers, programs, safety has been a really big thing. And so we're seeing a lot of that. And then, you know, repurposing, you know, buildings, expanding or shrinking capacity, building a new school, that type of stuff. So that's kind of what we've been seeing some of.
Yeah, and we will be talking with Eric about school safety quite a bit in the next segment. But let's go back to teacher retention. What does that usually mean in practice when a school says they'll improve it with more money from a referendum?
Right. So the first thing I think a lot of people need to know about teacher retention is that it's very complicated. There are a lot of factors that go into making a teacher want to stay in their classroom. And so when a district is talking about teacher retention, there are several ways that it could go. It could go towards better pay for their existing teachers. It could go toward, you know, hiring a new teacher to shrink class sizes and make them a little bit more manageable for the leaders of those classrooms. It could be, you know, buying supplies or some sort of support staff within the district. It's really teacher retention is kind of making the working conditions for teachers better. So they don't, you know, find reasons to leave or, you know, decide to leave because they can get paid more in a district $10,000 10 miles away. So it can really go several ways, but it's really just, you know, the different aspects of, you know, making a teacher's life nicer in the classroom, I guess.
Yeah, it can mean a lot of things. Now, a lot of these districts have referendums for the first time, right?
Yeah, so half of the school districts that have referendum measures up for consideration next week are first-time asks. So they've either never proposed one or never passed one. So it'll be interesting to see what the voters in those areas do. There are some places that, you know, can pass those pretty consistently. Zionsville, for example, is, I think, proposing their third or fourth. And, you know, districts like Noblesville have passed quite a few of them. So we've got some newbies, and it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how voters are receptive to that or not.
So what do superintendents make of doing or proposing referendums? What does it take to get this done? And what are some things you've heard as you talk with district leaders?
Yeah, so proposing a referendum means having to conduct a campaign. When you talk about people's taxes, they have a lot of feelings about that. And especially when someone doesn't have a kid in the school system or aren't, you know, directly involved in the school system, you really have to, you know, as a district leader, you have to convince the people that will be voting that this will benefit the community and not just the schools. So the superintendents that I've talked to, you know, I've heard that the language that the state uses on the ballot questions can be confusing. And so a lot of the efforts in these referendum campaigns is to, you know, clarify what exactly this means, how people's tax bills will be affected by this, and, you know, really explaining those benefits and being really specific about, you know, what they intend to use that for. So it's a lot of work. I mean, you've got people conducting meetings, just meetings on meetings to explain a lot of that stuff. And then, you know, publicly, you know, trying to share information. And then if there are people who, you know, are opposed to those taxes and trying to have, you know, pushback on that, just having those conversations ongoing so you can win more votes for the people, more yes votes for the people who decide to, you know, make their voices heard on that decision.
Now, we talked about teacher retention being one of the reasons we look for referenda or referendums. But let's break that down to a basic part, I guess. There was a summer committee at the State House looking into the effect referendums have on teacher pay specifically. What did they find?
Yeah, so this was one of the more interesting meetings that I've been to at the State House. So it was cool to look at this data because it's a question I've been wondering too. And so they were looking at the different types of language used in those questions when, you know, the districts request to file and ask, propose a referendum. And so they found that teacher pay, districts, you know, will raise teacher pay over 2 years, but they're kind of, that's the time that they were looking at. And so for schools that pass referenda, they generally see about a 2.3% on average increase in teacher salaries over 2 years. And that's just for a general operating referendum that doesn't specifically mention teachers. But then when you see districts specifically mention things like finding and keeping teachers, teacher retention, teacher pay, the teacher pay in those districts that pass referendums focused on teachers, their pay raises about 3.7% over 2 years. And then so you get a boost in districts that pass referendum at all, and then a bigger boost when they mention teachers specifically. And in districts that don't pass referenda, don't have those funds, teacher raises, the average teacher salary increases by less than 2%.
So it seems like recent pushes for better teacher pay could lead to more referendum votes, especially if they mention something about teacher retention. But how much do you think politics might make a difference here?
Right. So, I mean, this year we've seen a lot of teachers come to the State House and rally outside of their schools. The Red for Ed movement has really just amped up in, you know, how vocal teachers have been, especially with, you know, state budgets and school funding on the table. So we've been hearing a lot of teachers talk about the needs of school funding generally, you know, beyond just teacher salaries. And so I think when it comes to referendum measures, especially in different, you know, communities that are smaller, you know, the politics there really could drive more people that are focused on these education issues into, you know, the voting booth. So when you know that there's a referendum in your community and you really care about teacher issues, you might be more motivated to get to the ballot box because of that issue specifically. So I think that, and, you know, when you've got people that are opposed to taxes or, you know, are more resistant to those measures, obviously, you know, they will be energized. But I really just feel like, you know, hearing all of these teacher concerns and seeing all of these teachers coming out in their red shirts and talking about school issues, it really could pull education voters out to vote more. So, but we also don't know what the effect will be. So next week will be really interesting to watch.
Jeannie Lindsay is an education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay tuned to your NPR station to hear more of her work. She joined me today from WFIU in Bloomington. Jeannie, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks.
Up next, we'll dive into a new kind of school referendum you might see on the ballot this year, one focused entirely on school safety. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Do you know as much as you want to about these school referendums? What do you think about school districts and how they plan to use the money? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our discussion on school referendums, I want to tell you about some previous shows we've done. Today is Halloween. I want to make sure we reference that. And if you're in the mood for some Halloween content, check out yesterday's show on haunted attractions and why some of us love being scared. And last week we did a show with Mark Merriman, the author of the Haunted Indiana book series. And he shared a lot of Indiana folklore and ghost stories. You can hear those shows and any other show we've done wherever you find podcasts. Back now to our discussion on school referendums. And it is referendums, right? Or is it referenda?
I think it's who you ask sometimes, but I like to go with referendums.
That's
what I like.
That's Eric Weddle, the education reporter at our flagship station, WFYI Indianapolis.
That's my choice.
Yeah. And he's been covering school referendums for a long time, so he would know. Eric, thanks for being here.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So we've gotten a general overview of referendums already. But there's a new kind of referendum that'll be on the ballot for one school district. How did the school safety category get created?
Sure. Well, you can say there's probably two reasons why. You know, one, I think everyone, most people would agree, school safety is like getting much more focused than ever, you know, right now, even though we're like 20 years after the Columbine shooting. I think recent events, you know, whether it's here in Noblesville or across the country, we've seen students rise up with March for Our Lives protests for more school safety. The issue is just there. So I think, you know, school districts and wanted to respond to the needs and to the concerns, and lawmakers also wanted to do something. But as we all know, you know, schools always want more money. The state really wasn't willing to give more money to fund safety initiatives, whether it's buildings or personnel. So they kind of did what they've done previously when the property tax caps were created. They let school districts go to the voters to ask for more money. So that's basically what this new safety category is. It's another referendum. We have the ones for operating budgets. We have the ones for buildings, capital projects. And now there's a third one for safety, which districts can go to the voters and say, we want more money for these safety plans.
And so what can districts do with a school safety referendum? Are there strict rules about it?
Yeah, so it can be tailored on it has to be tailored on specific school safety issues. So school resource officers, mental health supports, school safety equipment, or training issues for staff, students, and community. And there's also rules on how much money you can ask for. So the maximum that can be sought is 10 cents per $100 of assessed value. So depending on the community, there's a different maximum amount of money that can be generated, but that's the most the levy can be. And if a school safety referendum is approved, schools are limited from seeking another referendum for 3 years.
Are there one or two things these districts want to do more than anything else to address these safety concerns?
I would say mental health supports. It's kind of one of the biggest things you're hearing from people is whether it's more counselors or more trainings to have students get direct support. Also, police officers or resource officers getting actually bodies into the buildings are the two areas you're seeing the most.
How does the level of interest for school safety efforts right now compare to the past few years?
Well, you know, like I said, you know, it's been 20 years since the Columbine shooting happened. I think it's really brought the country focused on that. But I mean, you know, we've had Sandy Hook in 2012, Parkland was last year, and then like I said, March for Our Lives has come up. I think it's just become this unavoidable topic, you know, and even when I see my friends who have children or I'm at my own child's school, safety is just, I think, in everyone's – it's everyone's focus now.
Well, and it hit a little closer to home a couple
right,
of
exactly,
years ago
yeah.
or a year
last
ago.
Year, yeah.
Are districts getting a lot of pressure from parents and the communities around them to make these changes?
Yeah. I mean, as a parent, I can say I hear that from my fellow, her daughter, those her classmates' parents. They want more safety issues. And from local superintendents I talk to, they're hearing it, you know, whether it's through formal surveys or whether it's indirectly in the community. And they just know, you know, people expect when their kid goes to school that it's going to be safe. And so they want to provide that environment. And, you know, a few of the superintendents I've spoken to recently, they said that's kind of their biggest fear right now is if something happens, did we prepare for it? Can we respond to it? Is what in place now going to, you know, prevent something, whether it's, a, you know, an armed guard, you know, for real, an armed guard can stop somebody, or are there mental health supports that's going to identify a student having problems before anything does happen?
And I mean, they have their list of things that they want. And this one and the one in Carmel is a safety referendum.
Yes.
I would imagine one like that, especially in an area like Carmel, is an easier sell than your regular run-of-the-mill referendum that covers a lot of different things.
I mean, I think it'd be difficult to maybe say that for sure, because I think every referendum, every school district, I think, has to like weigh different things, you know, and I think they have to kind of appeal to this broad base of people. Why, especially if you don't have kids in that district, why should I pay more money? You know, and I think you have property value issues. You have someone they don't want to pay more taxes. Mm. You know, so I think it's it depends on who lives in that community and like maybe even the age of the community. You know, I mentioned the Lawrence Schools Township seeking a referendum next week. The superintendent told me that is one of their concerns is so many people there don't have kids in Lawrence schools.
Mm, yeah.
And they try to pitch it as a way to say, hey, this is going to help your property values and keep the community safe.
Yeah, we can get into the social contract all day, but let's get into a couple examples,
sure.
Starting with Carmel, the one district that's got a dedicated school safety referendum up for a vote. What will voters actually see when they look at that entry on their ballot?
So when they walk into the voting booth, they're, you know, open the ballot up, this usually questions usually at the end of the ballot where questions are. And basically, it'll have the technical information that lays out the increase in terms of the cents per assessed value, what that is. And then for Carmel, it actually says the money is going to go for safety issues. And it actually says hiring school resource officers and programs for mental health and professional development to reduce violence. So that's written on the ballot.
Well, so let's talk about what the district wants to do in detail since they've outlined it and released that information. First of all, how much of a property tax increase are they pitching and how much money would it get them?
Sure. So the overall amount is $40 million, 40, over 8 years.
Wow.
And they're going to get that from assessing 5 cents per $100 of assessed value, so that the tax will increase by 5 cents for every $100.
So half of what they could
ask
for.
Half of what they could, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that would give about $5 million per year over those 8 years.
So what do they say they're going to do with that money if they get it?
So a big part of it is they want more officers in the school. Right now they have a few. They want to have one in every school district. They have 7 officers now, and 3, you know, are assigned to multiple schools. They want to add around 11 more officers, you know, which for one is going to be – it's going to be a challenge for them to find that many people. But I mean, that's a lot of money. So a big chunk of the money is going to go to those 11 more officers. They also want to get into a contract with the mental health provider to provide therapy for students. And basically what that is, they want to kind of like reduce the barriers for parents if their child needs more intensive mental health counseling and have them get that in the school from a mental health counselor. So they don't have to pick their kid up, take them out, you know, mess with their schedule. They can all get that within the school.
That's a big thing I hear a lot about. It's interesting they're approaching it that way. The police officers that they hire are referred to as school resource officers. What do they do in their role at these schools?
Sure. Well, I talked with the Carmel Clay School Superintendent, Michael Beresford, and this is how he explained to me what he sees their role to be outside of being a law enforcement officer.
And it's not just to, you know, to be an armed guard. School resource officers are really part of the fabric of the school. And of course, they're there for response, but they're also there for prevention. And they get to know kids and they serve as mentors for kids and they teach in some of the classrooms and they work with the staff. And it's the best thing about school resource officers is it's one person and they have one job, and that is to keep everyone in that building safe. And that's the biggest portion of the school safety referendum. We want to make sure that we have a highly trained Carmel police officer, a school resource officer in every school building in our district.
Let's get back to mental health, because that's a focus mm-hmm. for some districts, including Carmel. What have you heard about why that might be more of a problem now?
What I've heard, you know, not just from Carmel but other places, is, you know, they're kind of addressing issues at a younger age. And Superintendent at Carmel, you know, that was also what he had told me when I spoke to him recently.
It's kind of alarming and maybe frightening, the number of kids right now that are really suffering from depression, anxiety. Those numbers we've seen skyrocket, you know, in the last 10 years. You know, is that the ages of the kids who are being diagnosed with depression, anxiety, or other mental health issues are getting younger. We're seeing them in the elementary school. We're seeing kids that have great difficulty in regulating themselves and controlling their behavior. So that's why it's even more imperative than ever that we get some more supports, more layers of support in place.
And I've heard that school social workers at Carmel get lower pay than the teachers. Is that becoming a problem for them?
Yeah, it is. They don't get as much money as other people in the school do, like teachers and school counselors. And there is a fear that if they don't get a higher pay raise, they could be out the door at a different district. And this is what the superintendent told me about that.
Right now we have school social workers in Carmel Clay, but they're paid significantly less money than the school counselors and the teachers. And other districts around us are hiring social workers, and they're all being paid at the teacher rate. And so we're not very competitive right now. I'm scared to death I'm going to lose some real talented social workers we have in our district. So we want to take a portion of that money to write their salaries.
You know, so you can see there's this – it's very – complex issue of school safety, I think. Just in looking at Carmel alone, you know, in Hamilton County, it's like there's many layers that they're trying to deal with.
Well, let's go to Center Grove.
Sure, yeah.
The district is not proposing a school safety referendum technically, but they are mm-hmm. hoping to make similar changes. Can they make any kind of safety changes they want under the type of referendum they have?
Yeah. So what they're doing, you know, it's called an operations referendum, and that's to get more money in the general fund and in school general funds. You know, that's where they pay teacher pay or most of other things outside of buildings. So, yeah, they're able to use that money for other needs.
And the details of Center Grove's referendum, how much of a tax increase is it and how much money would they get?
Yeah. So they're looking to get nearly $25 million over 8 years. And down there, the property taxes would see an increase of 11.5 cents for every $100 of assessed value. Hmm. So as you may remember, safety referendum is only 10 cents.
Yeah.
So by them doing this, they're getting less money than Carmel, but they're able to ask for more of a rate. And so that's what they're doing there.
And the details of what they want to do with respect to school safety changes, what do they have outlined?
Yeah, they have a very explicit outline, and so does Carmel. Theirs is called the Safety and Security Support Proposal. And basically, they have identified 10 projects that include more officers, live video monitoring, expansive mental health supports, and cybersecurity, among some other areas that they want to increase security on.
Center Grove had a safety audit done last year. What did that look like? And is that a common thing, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think more and more districts are looking at that. They're having experts come in and just kind of assess what's happening at the school, how things are working. You know, it's, as you would say, soft spots, hard spots in the schools. So they had Safe Havens International, which is a well-known school security group, come in and kind of do an assessment, an audit of the district. And that kind of helped them kind of see, as they told me, what was right and what wasn't working there.
So they used this audit to help put their referendum plan together?
Yeah. So Superintendent Richard Arkanoff, he had explained that, yeah, they did this. They did that. They also went on a tour to Littleton, Colorado, to kind of see what was happening out there.
Oh, wow.
And they kind of had their eyes pretty much opened about, what they could do there in Johnson County. And I interviewed him about that recently, and this is what he had to say.
Yeah. It was something we were slightly aware of. It was growing in this district. And when we went out to Littleton, we realized this is a national crisis. And we that helped us then realize that we needed to take more action, and particularly, in the idea of being proactive. So that really was the piece that helped us kind of, open up our eyes to, we need to take more proactive measures. This is one of the undercurrents of some of the really significant issues happening in our communities and as far as violence goes.
And they also used a community survey on school safety to inform their proposal. What'd they take from that?
So after they went to Colorado and after they did this audit, they then asked, the school community and the local community what they wanted to see. And this is what the superintendent told me he heard loud and clear from them.
And what we heard from parents, particularly in our survey, was we really want a police officer in every building. We want that sense of security that we have someone in our building for that quick response time. So that was a really big ask in our survey from our community is, if you can reduce that response time by adding police officers, then please do add more police officers.
And you would think that most parents could get behind this, but was there any pushback to these safety changes that you've noticed from parents and communities?
I really haven't seen a pushback to – I think there is a concern of police officers in schools. There are people, who see that could lead to a sort of school-to-prison pipeline when you actually have local law enforcement in the school dealing with students, maybe arresting students, that can create this different kind of interaction. But I think a lot of people want an officer in the school who can respond immediately to some kind of threat, instead of having, to wait for the police to come. I do think there is a loud pushback we've heard from teachers being armed. And I think a lot of people feel much more comfortable having a trained police officer in a school building versus a teacher who has a gun.
What's the long-term plan for districts like this with school safety efforts? Do they want to get to a point where they can sustain what they have with their regular budget?
I mean, I think that is the biggest challenge right now. Like Center Grove, I think they are in the bottom 20 of schools being funded from the state. Carmel, I think they're in the bottom five for how much money they get. So they are seeing these referendums as a way to pay for these things. I mean, they want to bake them into their budget, but they don't really know what's going to happen. And as Senator Grove told me, they don't know what the next threats could be, you know, next year, whether it's, you know, cyber threats, which really isn't kind of what you think of for school safety, but there's a lot of data in the schools that could be held hostage or taken. So I think, you know, they're just trying to figure out how what to do kind of year by year right now. And hopefully these 8-year-long referendums is going to give them some kind of stability to plan for that and kind of branch out and kind of spend that money in the areas where it's needed.
Like we talked about, Carmel's the only district that took up the new option to propose a fully school safety focused referendum. Since that was made possible by lawmakers, do you expect more schools to do it the next chance they get?
I think it's going to be a wait and see. I think people are going to look at Carmel, you know, and see how the community responds to that. And I think, you know, we're also going to look and see what about that rate? You know, there is a limit on the amount of money that can be requested in that levy, you know, the assessed value increase. So I think school districts are probably going to have to decide what other needs are, you know, if they wanted, you know, to build a building or they wanted to, you know, last year, you know, IPS had a very large referendum for teacher pay. And they had a much smaller referendum for capital projects to look at safety, more on like hardening the buildings and so forth. So I think it's going to depend on what the school district needs, because I think teacher pay is going to be one of the biggest draws for referenda, you know, looking forward as schools try to, you know, increase the salary for teachers. And then they're going to try and balance that with how much tax increase can our community take and how much support is there for, you know, teacher pay, a new building, or all these security enhancements. So it's a lot for school. I think the school's a juggle and figure out.
Eric Weddle, education reporter for WFYI Indianapolis. And I just heard you say referenda.
I know. I caught myself.
He also works for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and has produced a documentary called The Takeover on the private takeover of two struggling Indianapolis high schools. He's busy updating that documentary now, and that version will be available this coming winter. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, more on school referendums. How have you voted when it comes up? Do you support all school referendums, or are you no new taxes, or maybe somewhere in between? And why? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelso. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the 13 school referendums up for a vote this coming Tuesday. So far, we've talked about what schools and superintendents are saying and how some districts want to invest in school safety efforts. Now we're going to pull back a bit to look at the bigger picture. Larry DeBoer is a professor and extension specialist in agricultural economics at Purdue University. He's joining us live from WBAA in West Lafayette. Thanks for joining us, Larry.
Glad to be with you, Matt.
Before we start, I'm curious, why are we talking school referendums with someone from agricultural economics?
Well, years and years ago, the Purdue University and the College of Agriculture decided that they needed somebody to deal with property taxes on farmland, which is a big issue for farmers, of course. And I'm the fourth person to hold this job since the 1930s, and it's not the job of keeping track of property taxes on farmland isn't big enough for a full-time position, so I branch out into all sorts of different state and local government policy.
Aha. So what data do you have to work with when you're studying this?
Well, for the referendums, whichever you like.
it's been the question of the day.
yes. Well, I taught myself to say referenda, and then last election, I think the AP style sheet said dumbs. So
anyway.
So now I don't know what to say.
So what data are you working with when you look at this?
Well, mostly with the data since November of 2008 in Indiana. And we've had 198 school referenda since November 2008. And that's a significant date because at that point, the legislature passed a law that said that capital projects had to be put to a vote. Prior to that, we had the remonstrance process, which was competing petition drives between supporters and the opponents. So we've had a lot more referendums since then. But also at that point, all of a sudden, we started to get a lot more of the operating referendums as well. Prior to that, we'd have one every couple of years. And since 2008 now, so that's about 12 years, we've had 106, I think it is. So, not 106. Let me get the numbers correct here. 111.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So a bunch, right? That's the data on the results that we've got, but that also gives us data on what's the date that it was. Was it May or November? Was it early, close to the recession, the Great Recession, or has it been since then? What tax rate did they ask? Was it a capital projects or a operating referendum? How big was the school corporation? All that stuff.
Yeah, that's I'm curious about that. What did referendums look like when they first started in Indiana in terms of what was actually being proposed?
Well, the same kind of proposals. We've had capital projects referendums and operating referendums all along. What has changed a whole lot is the rate at which they pass. In the first few years, they were defeated quite often. Before 2014, less than half of all the referendums actually passed. And since then, it's been more like three quarters have passed. So that's been, I think, the major change from then till now.
Yeah. What do you think is the reason for that?
Well, I've got a number of hypotheses, if you want to sound scientific. After all, I'm at Purdue here, right?
Sure.
One possibility is the recession, right? We started with this process in November 2008 at the absolute trough, the worst point of the Great Recession. And it may be that people looked at that and said, well, I support my schools, and sure, I'd be willing to pay for them, but not now, for goodness sakes. And the further we've gotten away from the Great Recession, maybe the more receptive people have been. Their ability to pay has gone up. But I think maybe a better explanation might be just the experience that the school corporations and the superintendents have had with campaigns. And certainly they communicate with one another on what works and what doesn't. Early on, I think the school corporations went forward and said, okay, folks, here it is, vote for it, and were a little surprised at how much opposition got generated. And after that, they started to treat these referendums as campaigns, as political campaigns, and hiring consultants who know about political campaigns to direct them. And I think probably experience has aided the or added to the passage rate over the years.
Yeah, just knowing what to put on the ballot. Now, 8 of the 13 proposed referendums this Tuesday are coming from school corporations that haven't proposed one before. What does that say to you?
Well, a couple of things. It might be that given the higher passage rates that we've seen lately, although one can point out that last May we only had 6 out of 10, which was the lowest rate in quite some time. But given these higher passage rates generally, it may be that school corporations that in the past would have said, no, we'll never get one of these things passed, are willing to take a chance. And, you know, losing a referendum is quite a blow to a superintendent and a school board. So you don't want to do it unless you think you've got a chance to try. And the fact that 8 out of the 13 are rookies might mean that. The other thing I look at is passage rates. Rookies have a tougher time passing referenda. School corporations on their first try tend to pass a little bit more than half of the referenda, and school corporations that have tried before that are trying a second time pass more than 80%. Rookies, again, I think experience counts. Gaining experience probably helps in terms of getting it passed. But rookies in the past have had a tougher time. So we're going to get a real nice test of that hypothesis here.
Are you surprised at all when you look at the changes being proposed in the referendums this time?
Oh, I don't know. I think they look as usual. Of course, the school safety referendum is new. So the first time we've seen one of those in Carmel Clay, as you've been talking about, in the 5 cents that they're doing. The rates range from that 5 cents and then 11.5 cents at Center Grove all the way up to 91 cents in Scott County, District Number 1 down in Scott County. And now 91 is one of the higher rates anyone's ever asked for. The 5 cents and the 11 cents, those are among the lower rates that people have asked for. And we've got quite a range on the project amounts as well, from $20 million in Scott County all the way up to $191 million that Lawrence Township schools are asking for. So it looks to me like the usual variety of rates and projects that like we've seen before.
Does it seem like higher tax increases typically mean less people vote to approve it, or is that not as much of a factor as you might think?
Well, it has to be. I'm an economist, right? Price has to matter.
Sure, sure.
If demand curves don't slope downward, if people don't respond to higher costs by buying less, then the very foundation of economics has been erased. So certainly they have to matter, Matt, but they don't matter as much as you might think. Now, there is a tendency. 25 cents seems to be a break point. Tax rates lower than 25 cents have passed about 70% of the time. Tax rates above 25 cents have passed a little bit more than 50% of the time. So there seems to be a dividing point somewhere in there. But last time in May, we had a school corporation that passed a rate more than a dollar. So it's certainly possible to pass referenda with high tax rates. And what that indicates is that, you know, I can sit here in my brick tower and look out at this data. But these are local elections, and they turn on local issues and things that I can't possibly measure, like the attitudes of the community towards the school corporation or how popular the superintendent is. Those things do matter with elections, and so we can look at tendencies with all this stuff, but these are local elections.
Yeah, a lot at play, and it seems like for Scott County, and again, a lot comes into the factoring, but 91 cents per $100 of assessed value seems like a big ask there, but it has passed before. Are some school corporations going for multiple referendums this time? How does it usually go when that happens?
We've got three of those this time, and so, yes, we've got eight referenda being asked for by rookies, but only six school corporations who are rookies, because two of them, Danville and Huntington, are asking for two. And then there's another one. Zionsville is also asking for two. So they're asking for both an operating and a capital projects referendum. And this, I forget now exactly how many, but we've had 15 or 20 school corporations go for two over the last 12 years. And the one thing you can say about it is that in every single case, either they both passed or they both failed. There's never been a split decision, which tells me that voters who come in see them as a package, and they either support taxing and spending more on the schools or they don't support taxing and spending on the schools. And they don't differentiate between the operating and the capital proposals from the school corporations.
Does it seem like school referendums help bring people out to vote at all? Or is it just something like they show up, they read it, and they say yes or no?
Actually, that's an interesting question. I think that plays into the May versus November election difference that we've seen. Elections that are held in May, of course, you can have these elections, these referenda, in two different elections. You can do it during the May primary election. You can do it during the November general election. If you propose in May, or school corporations that have proposed referendums in May, 74% have passed, and in November, 54% have passed.
How interesting is that?
Isn't it? And the idea that I think might explain this is that in November, people come out to vote for president and for governor, for statewide elections, and look down the ballot and say, oh, look, a referendum. Maybe not even knowing in advance that there was going to be a referendum, and they see it's a tax increase, and perhaps vote no. In May, the people who show up tend to be people who are interested in the referendum itself, and those are often, I think, the share of supporters in that group tends to be a little bit greater. Now, that begs the question, though, this particular election isn't a national or a statewide election. Here we've got some mayor's races and some other local races and the referendum. So the question is a November in an off year more like a May? So we'll test that hypothesis, too.
Yeah, certainly. We'll find out next week. Now, what do you think about how much information is actually on the ballot for these? There's got to be a lot of people who won't take the time to research the details online, and they'll find out about it at the voting booth, and maybe they don't even know where to find the information ahead of time.
Well, this is a kind of tension there. And, you know, there have been bills and a couple have passed, and certainly the Department of Local Government Finance has some rules about what has to be said and what the phrasing can be on the referendum that you actually read when you go into the voting booth. You know, it's got to be neutral, and that's what they look for. You know, it just describes what we're going to spend the money on and what the tax rate is going to be. But there have been some attempts to pass legislation that would add verbiage, a better description of what it is. And you can certainly understand why that might be. Certainly both the proponents and opponents of a referendum would like the voters to understand what they're voting about. You know, we're going to do this and that with the money. Here's what will happen if we don't pass it. Here's what will happen if we do pass it. Here's how much you pay. If you own a typical house, here's what your tax bill will go up. All of those things matter. Problem is, the longer you make the verbiage, the paragraph in the voting booth, the less likely are people to read it. And so there's a tension there. Is there some sort of happy medium that you can find about a adequate description of what you're voting on, but short enough that people will still read it?
Yeah, how important is it that people understand the nuance behind some of these before they vote? Are they straightforward enough that you don't really need any more information than what's on there? I guess that's kind of what you're getting at, is that it's really kind of, it's got to kind of be crafted to not be too long, but also have everything you need to know.
Yeah, for example, the Hamilton Community School Corporation up in DeKalb and Steuben, it's a cross-county school corporation. They've got a tax referendum for 44 cents going here on November. If you vote for that tax referendum, will your tax rate go up is the question. Well, as it turns out, that 44-cent rate is a continuation of a 44-cent rate that they passed 7 years ago. So if you vote in favor of it, then your taxes stay the same. So in a sense, you could say, hey, this is just a continuation of what we've been doing all along. If you like what we've been doing all along, let's keep doing it. On the other hand, and an economist, right? So you got to give me two hands. On the other hand, if you vote for it, you're preventing your tax rate from going down by 44 cents. And so people who want their taxes lower could vote no and say your taxes are lower. So when we describe it in the paragraph, what do we say? This is 44 cents, but your taxes won't go up? Or this is 44 cents to keep your taxes from going down? The phrasing of these things can be contentious, because you can phrase it one way that seems to ask for passage. You can phrase it another way that begs for rejection.
Now, you're the extension specialist in agricultural economics at Purdue, and so I need to ask this question. You've said that farmers typically fall into one camp on referendums. What's their role been?
I need to be careful about this.
Of
let
course,
me point
of
out, being in the College of Agriculture, let me point out that farmers generally have a great respect for education. Why not? After all, farming is a high-tech business, and a great deal of education is required if you want to do it right. These are, you know, fairly good-sized businesses full of all kinds of marketing and financial planning, as well as agronomy and entomology and all that stuff. But farmers would prefer, I think, not to pay for schools with property taxes.
Because they have more property, right? Is that what it is?
They have a tremendous amount of property, and property taxes hit them pretty hard. You know, a typical farm where the farmer is actually earning their income from the farm is going to be 2,000 acres, and an awful lot of the big farms are bigger than that. And at $2,000 an acre assessed value, and at $2 per $100 assessed value, that amounts to tens of thousands of dollars of property tax payments. So it's a major business cost for farmers, and so they would prefer to pay for schools in some other way. Unfortunately, there is no other way. You can't go for an income tax or a sales tax referendum. Only property tax referendums are required. So, and I just said referendas. That's splitting the difference there, right?
There is a reason Latin is dead.
Yes, so, indeed.
So do you think that stance could change for any reason, being, you know, against property taxes going up for referendums?
Oh, I think so. I think farmers just have a tendency to prefer not to vote for property taxes. But you know, the need for additional school spending, if it is evident, or the need for new facilities, if it is evident, could overcome that, I would think. And that's true of all of the data that I've got here. It's all just tendencies. There are no locks that if you do this one thing, yes, it's going to pass. If it's this other thing, then it will fail. You know, these are all percentages. So even if I say 75% pass in May and 50% pass in November, that still means 25% are failing in May and 50% are failing in November. So these are just tendencies.
Yeah. Larry DeBoer, professor and extension specialist in agricultural economics at Purdue University, thank you so much for joining us.
It was fun, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Maggie Galon, Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow is the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We'll be back tomorrow for that. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.